couple questions for you about
them. Okay. And then you're going to ask me for something?
No, not at all.
You want me to mow your lawn or?
Welcome back to The Lead, a podcast about content marketing by Copyblogger Media, hosted by me, Jared Morris, and Copyblogger's chief copywriter, Damian Farnworth. The Lead is brought to you by Authority Rainmaker, and Authority Rainmaker, as you probably know, is Copyblogger's second annual live content marketing networking event in Denver, Colorado. It takes place May 13th through the 15th. It is going to be held at the stunning Ellie Calkins Opera House, and it is a great opportunity to learn practical lessons that you can put into place as soon as you leave the conference. It's the way the conference is set up. It's a carefully curated single track where we'll talk about design and traffic and conversion and content and really give you a roadmap for how to improve your content marketing strategy. And then, of course, you add to that all of the great speakers who will be there, Henry Rollins and Sally Hogshead, and today's guest on The Lead, Dan Pink and Chris Brogan, and so many others, plus the networking opportunities with like-minded individuals to share contacts and share stories. And it really is going to be a unique, exciting, useful event. And above and beyond all that, I'd like to meet you. Damian would like to meet you. And so we can do that at Authority Rainmaker in Denver. So go to authorityrainmaker.com, get the details. And if you don't have a prior obligation already, we hope that you will join us there. So, speaking of Authority Rainmaker and Dan Pink, who I just mentioned, he is our guest today on The Lead. And Dan Pink is a prolific author, a deep thinker, and just a really genuinely curious guy who seems committed to flip conventional wisdom on its head. And you can certainly see that with his last two books, Drive, which came out in 2009, To Sell as Human, which came out recently. And, you know, Drive is a book that kind of flips on its head what we think motivates us and shows us what really motivates us. And with To Sell as Human, Dan talks about, you know, the surprising truth about moving others and how so many of us are selling a lot even when we don't think we're selling, and what kind of personality types are good at sales, and just so many different ideas that if you haven't really looked at it deeply, you may not understand, and it may flip how you think about it. And so on this episode of The Lead, Dan and I talk about that. He shares his insights, gives you a little bit of a taste for what you will hear at his keynote at Authority Rainmaker. So very appreciative of Dan for taking the time, and very excited to share this episode of The Lead with you. So here is my interview with Dan Pink. My guest today on The Lead is Dan Pink, who will be one of the keynote speakers at Authority Rainmaker, as I just told you. And, you know, it kind of dawned on me, Dan, before we jump in and start talking about your book, in reading your books, Drive and To Sell as Human, and listening to your podcast, you have an incredible network of people that you can call on for interviews and for insight. And for everybody who's coming to Authority Rainmaker and who's going to these networking events, do you have any tips or insight about how to approach an event like this, or how to approach building your network in general?
For me, I think if you're like genuinely interested in what other people are doing and you reach out to them and show your genuine interest, then you can probably strike up a conversation. And that's really where it all begins. I mean, I've said many times that everything good in life begins with a conversation. So if you have, you know, if you're interested in what someone else is working on, or you are doing something that you think connects to somebody else, and you're genuinely interested in them, you don't necessarily have an ulterior motive, then I think most people are fairly receptive to it. What I don't like is on the receiving end of it is someone who says, "Hey, Dan, you know, first paragraph, I love your book. Second paragraph, can you do this for me?" Yeah. You know, what I like better is someone who emails me and says, "Hey, that I saw that thing you wrote. That was really, really interesting." Or maybe comes back 6 months later, "I saw that thing that you wrote. Another thing that you wrote. Hey, can I ask you one question about it?" Today, there are negative returns to that kind of gamesmanship that a lot of us think is networking.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you. And on that point, I did read a couple things you wrote, and I do have a couple questions for you about
them. Okay. And then you're going to ask me for something?
No, not at all.
You want me to mow your lawn or...
Not at all. Not at all. So let's talk about To Sell as Human, which I found to be just a fascinating read.
Why, thank you.
You know, you talk about how sales have changed over the years and you know, hit on this idea of how we've shifted from caveat emptor to caveat venditor. Hopefully I pronounced that right.
Yeah.
And this idea of non-sales selling. So I'm hoping you can start out by opening up with this, with kind of the big picture idea that you're getting across in the book.
Okay, yeah, sure thing. There are two big picture ideas, really, and they're connected. One of them is that if you look at what people do all day on the job, they are selling in the broad sense of it. Now, some people obviously are selling toaster ovens and architectural services and industrial supplies. But if you and we have some interesting data on this, if you look at how people spend their time who aren't in sales, they are actually spending their time persuading, influencing, convincing other people that it's, and I call it in a somewhat clumsy way, non-sales selling. So it's sales, but the cash register is not ringing and the transaction isn't denominated in dollars. It's denominated in some other kind of unit, a unit of attention or effort or commitment, something like that. So one idea is that whether we like it or not, and many people don't like it, white-collar work today especially involves an enormous amount of selling, whether explicitly products and services or this non-sale selling, which is essentially just persuading, influencing, convincing. That's one idea. The second idea, which you referred to, is that we're doing it, all this persuasion, all this influence, all this selling, on an utterly remade landscape. And this is actually a big deal. Most of what we know about sales, go back to like sales, has come from a world of information asymmetry, where the seller always had more information than the buyer. Okay, so when the seller has more, if I'm selling you something and I have a lot more information than you, I can rip you off. This is why people don't trust salespeople. It's why sales has a bad reputation. And most of our experience in sales as sellers and as buyers has been in a world where the scales of information are not balanced, information asymmetry. But one of the most remarkable things that's happened over the last 10 years is a move toward greater and greater information parity between buyers and sellers of anything. And you see this, I think this is just such a big phenomenon, and somehow it's escaped our conscious notice. So we move from this world of information asymmetry to one of information parity. As you say, a world of information asymmetry where the sellers have a lot more information than the buyer, when the buyer doesn't have many choices, when the buyer can't talk back, that's a world of buyer beware, caveat emptor, exactly. But we now live in a world where buyers have lots of information, sometimes as much as sellers. Buyers have lots of choices, and I think this is really important, buyers have all kinds of ways to talk back. And that's a world of, buyer beware is always a good advice, but that's a world of seller beware. Now the sellers are on notice, and this move toward information parity has affected every market for everything, no matter how we define what a market is. So you see it in like the market for cars. You go into 20 years ago, the car dealer has an advantage. Today, you go into the car dealer and you know as much about cars as much about Hondas and as much about Accords as the car dealer. You see it it's happening in medicine, where it used to be the doctor was the only one who had access to any information. Now you have patients going in there with reams of information about their ailment. And now medical schools are saying, how do you treat people? How do physicians behave in a world where they have to persuade people who are coming armed with information, some of it good, some of it not so good? You see it in jobs. A lot of times when an individual would interview for a job not that many years ago, he or she was kind of going in blind. It was hard to do a lot of due diligence on that company. Now you can go to your LinkedIn network. You can go to glassdoor.com to see what it's really. It's true in the market for mating. I mean, you know, I think I'm 50 years old and, you know, I met my wife in 1990 and, you know, that's a long time ago. There was no, unfortunately, she couldn't back then Google me before she started talking to me.
And what this means, I think, is that we need to change our mindset when we are trying to sell or when we are trying to move other people. You know, and you present the example, kind of the old school model that everybody has seen from a movie like Glengarry Glen Ross, right? With these big, you know, the big alpha males that, you know, always be closing, and kind of this idea that you can almost just intimidate people into a sale.
Right.
And you contrast that with what I thought was one of
the best quotes in the entire book by Gwen Martin. And she says that humility is the most common thread in people who are really good at moving others. Why humility? Because that's not often a word, I think, or a trait that we associate with people who are good at quote-unquote sales.
Yeah. I think you're onto something really big there, and even implicitly. Because, even the way you put it. So you talk about this contrast between this alpha male approach, and then you talk about this other approach, which is suggested not by a man, but by a woman. And there's all kinds of reasons for humility. But part of it is that it's an accurate account of the situation. So when you're in any situation, in any kind of persuasive encounter, again, whether you're selling management consulting services or you're selling chicken pot pies at a farmer's market, you as a seller don't have an edge. You don't have access to all the information. You don't have you can't lord over your information advantage over your prospect or your customer. And that, I think that inherently puts you in a humble position. You're in a position as a peer rather than as an overlord. And I think that's one big reason. The other big reason is if you look at the qualities that are now necessary in being effective in this remade landscape of seller beware, one of the most important qualities is something that I call attunement or perspective taking. And it turns out, based on some really, really interesting research, that those who are humble are actually better perspective takers than those who are not. That is, people who feel powerful, people who have an inflated sense of self, that actually distorts their ability to see others' perspectives. And today, when we don't have much coercive power in a marketplace, inside of a company, as a boss, wherever, when we don't have coercive power, we have to have the very kind of almost the converse ability, which is to see other people's perspectives, find common ground. And that capacity is made easier with several doses of humility.
And so you mentioned attunement, and attunement is actually the A in a redefined set of ABCs that you have in this book. Attunement, buoyancy, and clarity, obviously contrasting with the always be closing idea before. Can you get into buoyancy and clarity as well and kind of complete that picture?
Yeah, sure thing. Let me take one step back, though. If you start with the premise that we're all selling, but that we're doing it in a completely different world. So the question that I then ask myself is, okay, how do you do it better? And for that, I looked to this pretty rich body of social science research over the last 25 years. Not much of it is about sales per se, but there's just a huge amount of research about how people make decisions, how people frame choices. Does sequence matter when people make a selection? How do you understand someone else's perspective? How do people bounce back from failure? This is just vast amount of research in all realms of social science, from economics to behavioral economics to linguistics to cognitive science. And so if you go wide enough and deep enough into this research, then I lucked out that they started with A, B, and C. I mean, that was just manna from heaven. I probably shouldn't admit that, but I just did. And so the social science suggests that these three qualities are the ones that are these kind of platform qualities to be effective in this remade world. And so one is attunement, which is being able to get out of your own head and see things from someone else's point of view. Buoyancy. Let's go to the B, buoyancy, attunement, buoyancy, and clarity. I got to buoyancy in an interview. And so I spent some time with a fellow last 40 years been selling Fuller brushes door to door, a guy named Norman Hall. And he said, and it's really poetic, he said to me, "Dan, what you don't understand about my job is that every day I confront an ocean of rejection." That was his phrase, an ocean of rejection. And, you know, that's pretty powerful stuff. And I just have an enormous amount of respect for people in sales, because they get rejected so much. Mm-hmm. And most of us can't take that very well. I mean, most of us avoid even being in a position where we might get rejected, let alone have rejection be this fixture in your life relentlessly. And so buoyancy is really, okay, if we're facing an ocean of rejection, how do you stay afloat? And the social science offers some really, really intriguing clues about stuff you can do before an encounter, stuff you can do during an encounter, stuff you can do after an encounter.
When you started talking about Norman Hall, and that's a thread that goes throughout the book, that was one of my favorite parts about the book, because actually one of my first jobs out of college was doing direct sales, both in businesses and residential. And He is so right about the ocean of rejection. I mean, it's just constant no after no after no, and just kind of getting to find that yes. And I will say that in hindsight, it's one of the best experiences I've ever had, and I'm so glad I did it, even though clearly didn't have much of a future. But
brutal at the time. What were you selling?
We were selling these little books of coupons, and they were actually they were pretty good deals. But you know, I will say that in terms of helping you kind of develop a shield of armor around your attitude, there's probably no better boot camp for it than that. Yeah. Even though it's certainly not something you want to do for the long term. But I love that part, you know, of the book and following him. And I wanted to ask, did he ever get Beth? I think it ended with he was going back to try and pitch her again on the brushes. Did she ever end up buying?
Oh, you know what? That is a great question. And I don't know the answer to that. I should find that out. That's a great question. Hmm. I'm going to guess, if I had a bet, I would put it at 95% chance that he went back to her, and probably a 75% chance that she ended up buying something from him.
Yeah, probably. Just the stick-to-itiveness.
That's my guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my guess.
The other thing that I found was so fascinating was, you know, with sales, we think a lot of times the personality trait for a successful salesperson is extroversion, right? If you just ask people, would you rather be an extrovert or an introvert to be good at sales, people automatically would say extrovert. But in your book, you explain that that's not quite the case, and there's something different almost in between those two that works much, much better.
You got that exactly right. This idea that strong extroverts make better salespeople is an absolute myth. There's no evidence of it. What's alarming, I guess, is that strong extroverts, you know, are the ones who often go into sales. They're often the ones who get hired. But when you look at actual performance, they don't do that well. But that doesn't mean that strong introverts are better at it. The real answer is something more subtle, as you suggest. And it comes out of some interesting research from the University of Pennsylvania. The people who do the best in sales are people who are what are called ambiverts. That is, you know, like an ambidextrous. Those are people who are not strongly introverted, not strongly extroverted. They're kind of in the middle. And there's some great research, as I mentioned, that shows that the ambiverts do better than the strong extroverts. The ambiverts do better than the strong introverts. That this idea that you have to be super extroverted to be successful in sales is flatly wrong. There's no evidence of it. But again, it doesn't mean you have to be quiet and mousy and perfectly introverted. What it means is that you have to be attuned. You have to be, you know, ambidextrous. I mean, Gwen Martin, who you mentioned, is a great salesperson in the Twin Cities area. You know, she calls it the ability to chameleon, which sounds sort of negative, but it basically is, can you understand other people's perspectives? Are you versatile? And the problem is that the strong extroverts talk too much and listen too little. And the strong introverts don't talk enough. And what you want to do is you want to be that calibrated person. You want to be ambitious. I mean, it's like, you're a basketball fan. It's sort of like, you know, you got to be able to dribble with both your left and your right hand. You got to be able to go left and you got to be able to go right. And you got to know when to do each. And that's what ambiverts do. They know when to push. They know when to hold back. They know when to speak up. They know when to shut up. And those are the ones who do the best. And I think what's really heartening is that when you look at the population, you know, most of us are ambiverts. There's kind of a bell curve of introversion and extroversion. You know, a few of us on one side are strongly introverted, but not that many. A few of us on the other side are strongly extroverted, but most of us are a little bit of both. And what it shows is that if you really want to be effective, you don't try to pretend like you're a super strong extrovert. You're probably just better off being yourself. You're going to end up being much more effective.
Yeah, and it also means that it doesn't take some real special type of personality to be good at sales, right?
No.
Even though we used to think that it took this special group of people, and I guess that's a good thing, right? Since, as you say, so much of what we do now is, it's not necessarily selling, but non-sales selling, where we're selling ideas, trying to move people. So this is all a good thing, right? This is something we should feel good about.
Largely, yeah. I mean, I think what it shows is that you don't have to pretend to be a certain way in order to be effective. You don't have to be that, you know, pat on the back, shoe shine and a smile kind of person. What you want to do instead is really be the best version of yourself. The other thing that's going on here is that, you know, as sales gets a lot more complex, as people begin as prospects and customers can solve their own problems. That changes things too. And so, you know, right now in sales of any kind, you know, including especially B2B sales, there's a premium on expertise. You have to know what you're talking about. You have to know your stuff inside and out. If you're selling to businesses, you better know what those businesses are about. You better understand those businesses. And so this idea that you can get away with just being kind of a smooth operator with a pleasant personality and a quick patter and a good suit, that's just outdated. What you really want to do now is you want to have some expertise. And there are if there's one personality characteristic that is effective in sales, as in many things, it's conscientiousness. Are you conscientious enough to do the follow-up? And are you conscientious enough to do the work that it takes to become a true expert?
So it's not the smooth talker or just the person who can make it sound good. Really, the big skill that we need is being able to sift through mass amounts of information and parse it for people. And
that's a big part of it. That's the C. That's the clarity. I mean, clarity is, you know, again, if you think about the transition, it used to be that if you had access to the information, you had a huge advantage. So if you think about medicine, you know, not too long ago, doctors are the only one who had access to any kind of, you know, real, you know, quick, voluminous information. But now everybody has access to the information. I mean, I can do a Google search just as well as my doctor can. And so having access to information doesn't give you a comparative advantage. This is true in other kinds of things, too. It wasn't that long ago when brokers were the only ones who could know what a stock price was. It used to be like not that long ago that investment bankers and brokers, you know, would call the CEO of a company and say, you know, Mr. Smith of GM or Xerox, today your stock closed at blah, 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 blah. You know, now my 12-year-old son, if I said to my 12-year-old son, hey, what's the market cap of Yahoo right now? He would be able to find that out. Mm-hmm. And so access to information doesn't give you a comparative advantage. What gives you a comparative advantage is exactly what you were saying, Jared, which is the ability to make sense of information, to curate the information, to separate out the signal from the noise in information. It's really a sense-making function, and that is a consequence of expertise. If you're a true expert, you can make sense of this wealth of information, find what's important, discard what isn't.
Yeah, and of course, to be attuned enough with the person that you're talking to or your audience to give them the information that's most relevant to them. Which I think hits on, you know, at the end of the book, you talk about this idea of servant selling. And I want to make sure that we talk about this because actually at last year's Authority Conference, I gave a presentation on servant leadership. And so I loved this topic of servant selling. What exactly is that? And as we kind of dial it in here to, you know, folks who are out there doing content marketing and creating content online to build an audience, how can that concept help people more effectively build effective, responsive audience online?
Yeah, well, I mean, you already know. I mean, you know servant leadership, so I don't want to torture you with the explanation of it. But for your listeners who don't, it's this fascinating idea that started in the 1970s by a guy named Robert Greenleaf. And what he did, which was actually kind of radical in his time, I mm-hmm. think we lose sight of how bold this was. He said, wait a second. You know, all of our org charts show the leader at the top. And Greenleaf said, no. The leader's at the bottom. The leader's at the bottom of the organization. And what gives you the ability to lead, what gives you the moral authority to lead, is whether you're serving. Are you serving other people? Are you serving the people who work at your organization? So you're not at the top. You're actually at the bottom. You're a servant to them. And you know, this is a really radical idea. And his point was that true leaders serve first and lead next. That service gives them, to use you know the word of the conference, gives them the authority to lead. And it's a powerful concept. It's taken hold ever so slowly in a variety of organizations. I think we're at a comparable point when it comes to selling, is that the very best sellers serve first and sell next. And I think that's what content marketers do, that serving other people. I mean, not in the sense of customer service, although that matters. You know, answer your phone in less than two rings, get back to emails within 24 hours, blah, 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 blah. But basically, are you actually of service to other people? Are you contributing something that makes their lives better? Are you contributing something that makes their businesses run better? And my view is that if you serve first and sell next, you're going to be fine. That's actually the way to do things today. And at some level, content marketing is that. I mean, ultimately, you want to have, you know, you want people to buy your goods or services. But I think there's actually an argument to sort of turning off that part and just saying, what can I do to be of service to people? And if you're in it for the long haul, it's going to work well. The trouble is that a lot of people aren't in it for the long haul. They think, oh, I'm going to, you know, send out one nice nugget of information, then I'm going to start asking them to sign on the line that is dotted.
Combining those two words, servant and selling, I think it's just really a microcosm of the shift. You know, in the book, you've got these these word clouds early on with people, you know, who are kind of using words that they associate with selling, and servant right. certainly does not fall anywhere in there.
Because we did the survey of 7,000 people, I have to go back and look. I would bet that the word servant was not on there.
Yeah, you know, because it's more, you think more like slimy or selfish almost, because
right.
selling
exactly.
is kind of supposed to be get you to do what I want to do, when really to be effective at, especially now, it's help someone else do something, help someone else achieve a goal, and in turn, it will help you achieve your own. And
exactly
I think
right.
it's nice that it's going in that direction, because it just, I mean, I think it makes everything that we do more pleasant. So I want to shift gears real quick. Obviously, we don't, you know, I talk about this stuff with you for hours, but I want to get to an idea that you actually wrote about in a previous book that you gave a TED talk on, because I think it's so fascinating. And that is this difference between extrinsic and intrinsic motivation.
Yeah. And I'll also offer a little bit of a twist on that to make it in the hope to make it a little bit more understandable. So extrinsic is motivation that comes from the outside. You do something because you get money for it. You do something because you get recognized for it. You do something because you get a prize. That's important. Intrinsic motivation is when you do something because you just want to, you know, because you want to do it. It's self-determined. You play the banjo because you like to play the banjo. And one of the problems, so just to be perfectly clear, extrinsic motivators are very important. Intrinsic motivators are very important. Where we run afoul is when we start using motivators that are both extrinsic, which is not the real sin, but also controlling. Mm. That's the real sin. So it's really a question of motivators that try to control people and motivators that don't try to control people. So let me give you a case in point. If a boss says, you know, if you do this, then I'll give you a bonus. If you do this particular thing, then I'll give you a bonus. We tend to think that's perfectly normal. And what the research tells us, 50 years of behavioral science, says that those kinds of motivators, those controlling contingent motivators, or what I like to call if-then motivators, if you do this, then you get that. Those if-then motivators are very effective for simple, algorithmic, routine kinds of tasks with short time horizons. They work pretty well. We like rewards that get our attention, that get us to focus. And so if you want to use an external controlling motivator to get people to stuff envelopes, to get them to turn the same screw the same way on an assembly line, go for it. It's actually, the science shows it's actually pretty effective. But, and this is the big but, the science also shows that if you want people to do things that require more judgment, more creativity, more discernment, more conceptual thinking, if the problem that they're trying to deal with is murky, if it's poorly framed, if it's multidisciplinary, if it doesn't have an easy algorithmic answer, if it's non-algorithmic, then those controlling external motivators, those if-then rewards, don't work very well. I mean, you know, it's really kind of frustrating because it's in the social sciences, not even a close call. And so if you want people to do creative work, conceptual work, what you're better off doing is not trying to control them with if-then motivators, incentivize them with if-then motivators. What you're better off doing is paying people well and then offering them some autonomy. Do they have some sovereignty over what they do, when they do it, where they do it, who they do it with? Sense of mastery, which is the ability to make progress and get better at something that matters. And finally, purpose. If people know that what they're doing makes a contribution, if people know what they're doing makes a difference. And so the problem, I think, in management writ large is that most management schemes are designed to control people. And the evidence shows very clearly that human beings do not do creative, conceptual, high-level work under conditions of control. Indeed, you could argue that human beings have only two reactions to control. We either comply or we defy. But you know, I don't know any organization that wants purely compliant people, and I don't know any organization that wants defiant people. What you want are people who are engaged, and the way that people engage is by getting there under their own steam with some measure of autonomy over, as I said, what they do, when they do it, how they do it, and who they do it with.
You and you outline all of these ideas in Drive. Have you seen a shift in the 5-6 years since that book came out in companies adopting this, seeming to understand this idea and putting it into practice more?
Ever so slowly. I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting, and I've written a little bit about this, are companies. Again, this is, I'm not talking like the massive companies, but there, you know, there are not insubstantial number of companies that are eliminating commissions for their salespeople. Because you know, sales is fueled by the ultimate if-then motivator. If you sell, then you make money. If you don't sell, then you hit the bricks. And there are a lot of companies that are realizing that those kinds of incentives can distort people's behavior. It's a reason why, you know, some of these companies that have developed their own culture, Netflix, Amazon, Zappos, Apple, they don't pay those kinds of contingent bonuses. Because they know that it can distort, they know that it can distort people's behavior. And so you have a lot of companies, a decent number of companies out there that are getting away from this very controlling form of compensation and instead paying people well, maybe doing something like profit sharing, but basically getting people to focus on the work and not on the money. And a way to do that is to pay people well, you know, take the issue of money off the table. And so you see it with companies that are eliminating sales commissions. You see it in some other ways. So I think that's taking hold, albeit very, very, you know, not in dramatic numbers just yet. But, you know, it all begins with people essentially challenging the orthodoxy about how things ought to be run.
You know, Dan, you and I have never met yet. I very much look forward to meeting you in Denver at Authority Rainmaker. You strike me as such a naturally curious guy, just, you know, in general. Have you decided yet what your next topic for a book is going to be?
You know, I'm cooking up a bunch of different ideas, and I'm trying to figure it out. One of the things that, you know, I'm interested in a few other things, but I'm also interested in the form of presentation too. And I just think there are a lot of opportunities out there to tell stories and deliver ideas in other ways, whether it's a podcast, whether it's a television show, whether it's a film. And I'm trying not to limit myself to only one vessel. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's a long-winded way of saying, no, I haven't figured it out yet.
Well, where is the best place for people to connect with you so they'll find out as soon as that's ready?
They can come to my website, which is danpink.com. They can sign up for our email newsletter, which is free of charge and free of advertising. And you know, follow me on Twitter at @DanielPink.
Yeah, and I highly recommend the podcast too. I know you said that you'd taken a little hiatus on the episodes, but just going back and listening to them, they're all still obviously very relevant and great conversations with some really influential people and deep thinkers. So highly recommend those as well. Well, Dan, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it, and I look forward to seeing you in Denver at Authority Rainmaker.
I'm looking forward to being out in the Mile High City for Authority, and it's been great talking to you, Jared.
Absolutely. Take care, Dan. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of The Lead. Once again, the URL for information about Authority Rainmaker and to get registered is authorityrainmaker.com, and early bird pricing is still available, so don't wait. Head over there, and hopefully we will see you in Denver. And of course, if you enjoyed this episode, if you have been enjoying past episodes, we greatly appreciate your ratings, your reviews over on iTunes. So thanks for letting us know. Thanks for letting everybody else know. And with that said, we will talk to you all next week with another brand new episode of The Lead. Thanks, everybody.